listen to my daddy and my Uncle Drew, not in a creepy way.
Oh, this is not going to go well.
You're exactly right.
Awkward.
Luckily, it's on your end. Ha ha.
I did not see that coming.
Welcome. I'm Eric.
And I'm Drew.
To start off tonight's show, we're going to talk about a little bit about the movie Primer that Brother Jay and I talked about a couple weeks ago, because Drew has his own thoughts about Primer.
Yeah, I just got done listening to your podcast, so it's fresh on my mind. I was a little disappointed in both your and Jason's reaction to it, because I watched it when it first came out on video, and I really, really liked the movie. And I think you guys sort of talked around what my thoughts were about the movie overall, but never sort of hit on it exactly. So I just wanted to throw it out there. You guys talked about how it was a time travel movie that wasn't very much fun. That Shane Carruth tried to really make the science plausible behind it. It sort of took away from the magic of a time travel story. So my thoughts on it were in alignment with that, but I thought it was very purposeful. My take on it was that Carruth decided he was going to answer all of the geek critics of time travel movies who complain that it's not realistic because when you travel back in time, you're going to change time, you're going to create these time loops. So I feel like Primer was sort of a meditation on why you wouldn't actually want to watch an accurate movie about time travel, because it's super complicated, it's hard to wrap your head around, and ultimately you're going to get so wrapped up in the mechanics that you're not actually going to be able to tell a cohesive story. And that's what I took away from Primer, was that if you like time travel movies, you don't want to watch a movie that really accurately deals with the problems of time travel.
I can see that.
I mean, it's sort of the exact opposite of Looper, when you have that scene between Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, where they start to talk about time travel, and Bruce Willis pretty much says, "No, we're not going to talk about it because it'll make your head spin." And that's sort of how they blow off the whole issue in Looper. So I just picture that as being the opposite of Primer.
Well, and if that was his goal, then he succeeded marvelously, because it all worked from that aspect of it. And I like the fact that a lot of what, you know, Jason wrote off at first as just bad acting, you know, they explained that since you don't really know which time loop you're watching, and so therefore you don't know how bedraggled the character is at any given point, or whether they're just going through the motions because they're saying what's on their script. You know, I think that explained a lot of that. But, I mean, like I said, the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, wow, I got to watch this again. You know, and then I did a little research and I found this big chart that had all of the time loops on it that is actually going to be in some sort of bonus part of that Primer episode. But then when I looked through all that, I was like, well, you know, I just want to watch the movie again to see if it worked as a movie. And that's where I thought, you know, it was basically a simple plan, but the simple plan did it better.
Yeah, no, I love a simple plan. That was a great movie. But yeah, I thought Primer was really, really subversive in the way that it sort of invites you to follow along, but at the same time, it's keeping you, it sort of deforming you away. Thing. You don't really want to be here. I mean, just, like with all the jargon, the technical jargon that's impossible to follow.
So I know you're not going to like me paraphrasing you, but so Shane Carruth is like Frank Darabont and he hates audiences? Or he's like Stanley Kubrick and he's like, I don't care if you like this movie. This is the movie that I want to make.
Yeah, I think a little bit. I think my take on it was, here, you think you want this, but you really don't, and I'm going to prove it.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, if that was the case, and he put a lot of his, you know, obviously he put a lot of time into it, and I'm sure as a percentage of the money he had available to him total, he put a ton of money into it. Now, I don't know whether...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think you're actually going to come up with what I was going to say.
Oh, I was just going to ask you if you've heard anything about his next movie.
Upstream Color? I've heard that it's complicated.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what he does with a bigger budget and more time and maybe access to real actors.
Well, exactly, yeah. No, I'm interested to see it. Although, again, it's one of the things where I think I will have to prepare myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Collateral. Collateral is a 2004 movie directed by Michael Mann, and you are a big Michael Mann fan, so I'm going to kind of let you take the reins on this one.
Collateral. I want to talk about Collateral because it was a movie that, when it came out, kind of came out under the radar. I was tracking it because I am a Michael Mann fan, and despite what I want to feel, I am a Tom Cruise fan also. You know, he tends to be just a really, really good movie star. So he's sort of compelling to watch no matter what you think of him personally. So I was interested to see the collaboration of Tom Cruise and Michael Mann. And at the same time, it was sort of a banner year for Jamie Foxx. So having those two leads, Collateral came out the same year as Ray. And Jamie Foxx was actually nominated for an Oscar for both movies in two different categories. And I think he should have won for Collateral, and I don't think he should have won for Ray, but that's a different argument. But Collateral is a small movie about a taxi driver who picks up a fare, and they kind of spend the entire night together because his fare turns out to be a hitman who essentially kidnaps Jamie Foxx, his character's name is Max, and forces him to drive him around while he completes his assignment. So that's it in a nutshell. It's a pretty small, pretty contained movie, and Tom Cruise is playing against type in it as the hitman Vincent. So that's my real brief synopsis.
Yeah, let me respond about Tom Cruise, because I think you said it actually better than I could have. I don't want to like Tom Cruise, but it turns out Tom Cruise, I mean, he's just a good actor, and he may not be the best actor. There's some criticism about how that he's a little over the top in a lot of what he does, but you're right. He is absolutely compelling to watch. I can't think of something that he's done that, you know, it hasn't been interesting.
Right.
And I was surprised about the cast in this movie, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, but yeah, it was. You also said it really well that it was a very small movie, even though it wasn't particularly short. I mean, I think I don't have the time here, but it, you know, it took its own time, although I don't think it was slowly paced. I just think it took its time, and I thought that was good. And I thought the music in it was fantastic. I mean, I was really impressed about all of the music in it. He just captures a certain tone with the way he shoots and the music behind it. I think right in the beginning of the movie, you're introduced to Jamie Foxx's cab driver Max, and you know his time, you know his place, you like him as a character, and you're there. You're automatically there. And so when Tom Cruise comes, he's just another addition to this world that at least I was very accepting of being in. I was happy to be in the cab with Max.
Yeah, it's kind of a Michael Mann trademark to really, really take his time with characters, often in silence. So you tend, in Michael Mann movies, you tend to watch characters at work, usually by themselves, not interacting with somebody. So you really get a sense for what they do just based on watching them, without any exposition, without them talking. And he tends to get really close up, so you feel like you're right there. And this movie had a lot of Michael Mann trademarks that I think were really effective. And maybe we can talk about those as we go along.
That's it. Maybe because there wasn't a lot of exposition, that's where the music, you kind of got a feel for it. You know, that's why it became to the forefront in the opening scenes, you know, seen from inside the cab. I just thought, you know, the lighting and the fact that it was at night, I mean, it made all the difference. It just, it gave you a sense of you don't have to worry about 1,000 other characters. You're just focused on these guys and their little trip. And you didn't, you know, you weren't lost in any of the surrounding part of it. It's like setting up a play.
Yeah, and even though there weren't that many characters, I think Mann did a really good job of capturing sort of the expanse of L.A. and used L.A. as a really effective backdrop for the story.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was excellent. I mean, I thought it was pretty. I mean, I have a little bit of problem with the ending of it, but I think it led in the direction he took us was fine. I was happy to go with it throughout the whole end of it.
Yeah, I mean, so what did you think overall of the movie? This is the first time you've seen it?
Actually, it wasn't. As it turns out, it was the second time I've seen it. I didn't realize it at first, but I had seen it before, and it turns out I liked it. I mean, I had good memories from the first time. As soon as I got into it and realized, oh, okay. Because I definitely remember the scene in the jazz club. So I had seen it before, and I think I had given it like 4 stars or something on Netflix. I think it's like a 4, 4.5-star movie.
Yeah, it definitely evoked a lot of feelings, reminding me of Heat, probably Michael Mann's most successful movie, and Heat is my all-time favorite movie. So I felt really comfortable watching Collateral. They're both set in L.A., and it felt like they could have been in the same universe. So I feel like the characters from Heat could have crossed paths with the characters in Collateral sort of seamlessly.
What I found interesting was that I had forgotten, at least two of the smaller roles, I guess. Mark Ruffalo, I don't know how to pronounce his name off the top of my head, but I find him very compelling to watch. I think he's a really good actor. And although I think his character didn't get what he deserved as far as, you know, his story ended pretty abruptly, you know, unsatisfyingly. It worked for the plot, the way it was going. And then I did not recognize Javier Bardem. Not at all.
You didn't recognize him the first time or the second time?
I don't remember him at all from the first time. It would be as a recognizable character. But watching it just last week, I didn't recognize him at the time either. And part of it was because I'm so used to that ridiculous haircut from, you know, No Country from Old Man on.
Yeah, I hadn't remembered that he was in it, but I think at the time it came out, he'd only been in probably one other movie I'd seen, the movie about being oppressed in post-Castro Cuba. I want to say before Nightfall.
Okay. See, I haven't seen that movie. And he did a bunch of Spanish language movies before, is that right?
Right. So I doubt I would have really recognized him as a name actor the first time I watched it. But also, there is that really bizarre Jason Statham appearance.
Yeah.
Very early on in the movie.
Yeah, and Michael Mann doesn't have anything to do with the Transporter movies, does he?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, because it seemed like it was Statham's Transporter character.
Yeah, it was really, really bizarre. It took me out of the movie. I actually had to do a double take because I thought, that random guy with no lines looks a lot like Jason Statham around it. And in fact, it was. And there was no callback. He never showed up again. That was just it. He wordlessly dropped off the briefcase for Vincent to start his night of mayhem.
Well, and it certainly wasn't the crank Jason Statham character, because then Jason Statham would have looked directly into the camera and actually winked. Like, I don't know how you feel about the crank movies, but for a whole other time.
Yeah, they're not memorable to me.
Ah, well.
Anyway. I think I've only seen the first one.
Oh, okay. Then at some point, we're going to have to see Crank 2. Because that's worth the price of admission. I mean, just seeing Crank 2 is simply amazing. Because with Crank 1, you can forgive a little bit of you can just think, this is just a stupid idea. But in Crank 2, you realize that it's a stupid idea that they're having a lot of fun doing. Anyway, that's a total digression.
All right.
So, Tom Cruise, one of the fair maidens I work with, who we'll call J-Mo. She, when I told her we were doing Collateral, she's like, oh, I hate that movie. I'm like, well, why? She goes, because that's, I think that was the movie where I figured Tom Cruise is a horrible overactor. Like, where the scene where he cracks his neck, at that point, she was gone.
Wow, she thought Tom Cruise was overacting?
Yeah.
In this movie?
Uh-huh.
Huh.
Which I thought, well, that's, she had a powerful reaction. And definitely, I mean, she definitely had a much bigger reaction than I did. I thought Tom Cruise was just fine. I thought his character was supposed to be sort of, you know, glib and slimy and just on the edge.
Yeah, I would characterize it the opposite way. I think he was, pretty understated for most of the movie. I mean, he's meant to be creepily calm while he's doing just horrendous acts. I actually thought his performance was rather chilling, compared to, you know, especially compared to what you would expect from the Tom Cruise, movie star hero guy. Definitely, playing a type for him.
And I think, I mean, chilling is right because he's doing horrendous acts, but he's also doing outrageous acts as well. And things are going horribly wrong in his world.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, things are going horribly wrong in everybody's world that he encounters, too.
Yeah, should we talk through some of the plot details a little bit?
Absolutely, yeah. We're going to, spoiler warning, we're going to talk about the whole movie, so.
Yeah, so the movie starts off focusing on Max, the cab driver, and it shows that Max is a pretty meticulous guy. He keeps his cab very clean. He takes a lot of pride in what he does. He definitely wants to be a great cab driver. He wants to know the best routes. He wants to be a good guy. One of the first opportunities we get to see some of his deeper character traits is when he picks up a lawyer played by Jada Pinkett Smith. It kind of flirts with her as he takes her to where he's going. And then at the end, when he drops her off, and he's been very successful with his flirtation, and won a little wager with her, you see that he just can't quite pull the trigger. He wants to ask her out. He wants to ask her a number, but he can't do it. And as soon as she walks away, he realizes that he missed an opportunity. So it's a really sort of pathetic scene for him. She comes back and gives him her number. But you can tell that this is a guy who right away, he just can't go all the way. He knows what he needs to do, but you know, when it comes down to it, he just freezes. So I thought that was a fun little way to start off and set up his character. It's also the first introduction of his overall life plan. You know, he doesn't want to just be a cab driver. He's working towards starting his own luxury limousine business. And that's some of the shtick he uses on the Jada Pinkett Smith character to try and impress her. After he drops off the lawyer and gets her number, Vincent pops into his cab. And Vincent sizes Max up right away. And he sort of asks the question, gets kind of the same shtick from him about him not, you know, just being a cab driver until he can get his business together. And then there's just that little moment when he asks the follow-up question, like, so how long have you been doing this? And Max says, 12 years. And you can just see in that moment that Vincent sizes him up and instantaneously knows that he's full of shit. And that starts off their night together. Vincent is seemingly a pretty put-together guy. He's polite, he's firm, he's got some charisma, he's dressed well. He actually, to me, again, being a Heat fan, he really seemed to be channeling Neil McCauley from Heat, the Robert De Niro character. I think they could have been related. He has Max drive him to his destination, and when they get there, he kind of bullies Max into letting him hire him out for the entire evening, even though that's against the rules for the cab company. He offers him, I think, $600 to drive him around all night and then take him back to the airport. Vincent made it very clear he does not like L.A. He does not like being in L.A. He just wants to get his business taken care of and hop on the first plane out of there.
The fact that Tom, or the Vincent character, is so put together. I mean, he is wearing an expensive suit and he's wearing it well. And Max, I thought, was sort of underdressed for the guy who is so immaculate with his cab. Although it's not his cab, actually. He just shares it with another driver.
Right.
But he's kind of dressed down. I sort of expected him to be a slightly better dressed. But anyway, so it focused you on the fact that Tom Cruise was actually like well put together. And yet, in a way that he was able to kind of move seamlessly through every place they went.
Right. He blended in, but not in a way that trying too hard. You know, if you had run into him on the street, you wouldn't have initially been intimidated by him. You probably wouldn't have thought about him after he passed you at all. Very understated, I think.
Yeah, on purpose. I think I read that they had him deliver FedEx packages in L.A. while trying not to get caught being Tom Cruise, and over him to play the part of Vincent who can just walk into any setting.
Oh, like his hitman training?
Exactly.
Oh, that's funny.
And it's hard to tell whether that's for real or, you know, because with I don't know how method Tom Cruise is and all that kind of stuff, so.
During these first couple cab rides, there was some great Michael Mann trademarks, sort of the street level view of the side of the car as it's driving forward with music playing. I think that's a shot that Mann has in a lot of his movies, even going all the way back to, you know, the iconic In the Air Tonight scene from the Miami Vice television show. That shows up in a lot of his movies. I was happy to see it here. Another one of his trademarks is sort of the straight on through the windshield view of both driver and passenger in the evening ambient light. That could have been a scene right out of Heat, and even going back to Manhunter.
Which we'll have to do Manhunter at some point.
You could talk me into doing Michael Mann's entire catalog.
Okay, well, we can make it happen.
Yeah, as a side note, have you seen Thief?
Yeah. The James Caan one?
Yes.
Yes, that's a fantastic movie.
Mm-hmm. I would never have seen it unless I had been looking up Michael Mann's filmography. And that's a great one. We should talk about that sometime.
Well, you know why I saw it? It wasn't because it was obviously playing on some kind of cable or whatever our equivalent to cable was at the time, but I saw it because it was the first thing I had ever seen James Belushi in. I thought, John Belushi's brother, that'll be great.
Huh.
Yeah, so going into it with that, it was like, it's you know, it wasn't exactly what I expected, but it was good. Gritty and good.
So getting back to Collateral, so while Max is waiting for Vincent to go in at their first stop and conduct his business, there's a rather jarring scene where a body falls onto his cab. And what I thought was a great reaction that I don't think you see very much in movies. In the world of movies, bodies tend to fall on cars more often than they should. But in this one, I think Max had probably the appropriate reaction. I crapped his pants and crawled out of the car, sort of in a crab walk fashion as fast as he could, and was kind of screaming like a little kid, wondering what just happened. And while he's doing that, Vincent shows back up and starts to take control of the situation. And Max realizes that Vincent had something to do with this guy falling off his car. And in a great line, Max accuses Vincent of killing the guy. And just off the cuff, Vincent tells him, no, I didn't kill him, I shot him. the bullet in the fall killed him, which is just sort of the first of a series of really funny and glib one-liners from Vincent throughout the rest of the movie.
Yeah, which is why, I mean, Vincent is a great character, and I think Jamie Foxx did a great job in this part of the movie being Max, who just has all this stuff heaped on him at, you know, with no preparation how to handle it. I mean, I think he does a good job being, like, confused and unsure of, you know, his character doesn't know what's going to happen, although he can guess it's not going to be great. And he's already been established as the rule follower. So having to do all these things. I mean, I thought the body fall in the cab was perfect. It was just great.
It's your first realization, you know, you saw before when Max didn't pull the trigger with asking the lawyer out. But as soon as Vincent really takes control of the situation, and there's no more subterfuge with him. He threatens his life now to drive him around for the rest of the evening. And you realize that Vincent is not an anti-hero. He is the villain and the antagonist of the story, which makes Max the protagonist. But even though he's the protagonist, he is in no way heroic. He's pretty meek and pathetic. And as you said, he plays it really well. You know, sort of what you would expect a normal person would react being placed in a situation like that.
And I think his performance actually made Tom Cruise's performance better.
Yes.
I mean, Tom Cruise being his Vincent being in so much control and super glib, I think was highlighted by Jamie Foxx being sort of not in control and not glib at all. I mean, he was, you know, mumbly and his lines, you know, were disjointed, and it worked to great effect.
And after they move on their way to the next stop, you get introduced to the Mark Ruffalo character, the cop who came by because the guy that Vincent killed was one of his criminal informants. That starts a parallel story of Ruffalo as Detective Fanning and his partner, Peter Berg, who didn't have much of a role, but he was kind of fun to see.
Now, was Peter Berg the detective that kind of tells him that he'll take it over and that kind of thing? Like the homicide detective?
He warns him that he shouldn't get too invested in it because if it really is a serial killer, as Fanning thinks it is, that the feds will just swoop in and take it.
Did you get the impression that he was going to end up being somehow in cahoots with the bad guys?
Never.
Okay, because I kind of did. From the beginning, maybe I was looking too much for clues, but I thought he was waving them off a little hard. Also, I was a little distracted by Mark Ruffalo's hair.
Yeah, I'm not sure who he was channeling, but that was sort of a great Pat Riley look.
Oh, it was great. And the leather jacket and everything. It was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out he's very compelling to watch, too. I watch him in almost everything.
Yeah, he's good. Then Vincent takes Max to the next stop, and he zip-ties him to the steering wheel as he goes in and kills his next victim. I think at this point he's told Max that he has five assignments to complete before he gets out of town. So this is the second of five. While he's in there doing the deed, Max tries to call some attention and get some passerbys to come down the alley where he's parked to try and help him.
As
it doesn't work out too well because he is mugged.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you would. I thought that was also another accurate thing that, you know, even in this sort of unreal world, that would be a real-world reaction. Okay, the bad guy is upstairs. You can honk your horn from the alley and see other people down on the main street. You know,
right.
Somebody can come and help you. He's zip-tied. He's not like he's handcuffed. Unfortunately, he attracts the attention of the wrong guys.
Right, yeah, and a great, what to me was a really jarring scene, Vincent comes out just as the muggers are getting away with Max's wallet and Vincent's briefcase from the back of the cab. And for the first time, you see Vincent in action. And when he confronts the muggers, there's two of them, one of them has a gun. He's really calm and when he takes action, it's really quick, and he shoots both of them just out of nowhere, very, very brutally, very efficiently, very emotionlessly, and collects his briefcase and gets back in the cab and really lays the blame of their death at Max's feet for calling attention to himself. But that scene where he killed them, it happened so quick that it really, really showed you how menacing Vincent really was. Because his first two assassinations took place off screen.
Yeah, no, the alley scene, you're right. It's great. Because you haven't seen what he's capable of. And you know that something is going to happen. He's going to get his briefcase back. But you don't know how short this encounter is going to last for these bad guys. And it makes him even more chilling when he gets back in the cab. And now, you know, Max knows how this guy operates too. So at this point, it seems like Max is pretty much decided he's in it for the long haul.
Yeah, and what I really appreciated about that scene was in I think a lesser quality movie, you would have had like some hand-to-hand fighting there, and had it been a more sort of extended action-y scene. This scene really cemented to me that, you know, even though this is kind of a cops and robbers movie, it's not an action movie at all. Maybe at the very end.
Oh, yeah, no, I could argue that even to the end, you're right, it's not an action movie at all. It's a whole different genre.
Yeah, it's definitely a crime drama. So after that, Max realizes he's pretty much screwed. And what I thought was sort of just a psychological ploy by Vincent to kind of take the pressure off Max, so that he doesn't just slip out before the end of the evening, because it's obvious he wants to use him. There's an implication by Fanning at some point that there had been another series of murders committed by a cab driver up in Oakland, and I don't know if you thought the same thing, but I thought the suggestion was that maybe this was Vincent's MO, is that he kind of kidnaps the cab driver and goes around killing a bunch of people, and then makes it look like it had been the cab driver all along, and who commits suicide at the end.
Yeah, no, I thought that was definitely the groundwork that was laid, that Jamie Foxx was not going to live through the end of the movie. Like, the last thing on Vincent's list was to take care of the cab driver.
Right, so that implication made it more believable that Vincent would have an investment in stringing Max along through the rest of the evening. So to take some of the pressure off, because he looked like he was cracking, he takes him to a jazz club to go hang out and listen to some jazz. And probably one of the best scenes in the movie, Vincent connects with the owner of the club, and he and Vincent and Max are all sitting at a table after hours, after the club shut down, just talking about old jazz stories and talking about Miles Davis. And you can see it's so benign and so relaxing that Max sort of forgets the predicament he's in, and he just gets into the stories and listening to the stories of Miles Davis coming into this guy's club years earlier. Then at the very end of the scene, you learn that this club owner is actually Vincent's third target. And in another really quick and brutal fashion, he executes him at the table that they're sitting at. It sort of snaps Max back to the reality of the situation he's in.
Yeah, Max loses it. He was a little bit more in control because of the jazz detour. But yeah, you're right. He snaps him back into the fact that, and it was also just like the alley scene. You know, it was super quick. And while you probably knew it was coming, you didn't realize exactly when it was coming. He pulls the trigger about a beat before you would expect him to.
Right. He offers the club owner an opportunity to get himself out of the situation if he answers a piece of Miles Davis trivia correctly. And he answers it with such confidence that you think he did get it correct. And, again, I think in a lesser movie, Vincent would have said, oh no, you're wrong. This is the real answer. And then killed him. But no, in this movie, he answers, he thinks he got the answer right. And then he's shot twice in the chest and once in the head. And this is an aside as he's pulling Max out. They can tell him the real answer.
Again, you've got a victim who does not see his own death coming. I mean, that was the beauty of it, is because the whole time you're trained on this jazz guy's face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you pretty much see, if I remember correctly, you see most of that little last conversation strictly with the camera on the face and the eyes of the club owner who was worried about getting killed but thinks he has just talked his way out of it.
Yeah, there were a lot of great close-ups in that scene. You know, when they were talking about Miles Davis and getting towards the end of that story, it cut back between close-ups of Vincent and the club owner. And right when you saw Vincent reveal himself and the reason why he's there, there was a great close-up on Tom Cruise where he went from sort of the Tom Cruise smile while he's talking about Miles Davis to talking about, I think he called it the cartel.
Yeah. Or his friends in, like, Cartagena. And
that's right. And in that instant, you know, the smile fades and sort of his eyes went black. And it was a great transformation.
Those three guys did a fantastic job at that in that scene. They just acted the crap out of that scene is what they did.
Yeah, and when you have some distance and you think about the movie after it's over, it's one of those scenes where you realize how small a movie it is. I mean, it's a really big moment. It feels really big at the time, and really full of, you know, dialogue and implications. But it's just three guys at a table. Like you said, it could have been a play. I mean, there's no movement. They're just sitting there. But it's probably one of the most effective scenes in the whole movie.
And it just, yeah, because it lulls you, the conversation, the story, just kind of like you see the movie like Max is seeing the event, where, you know, you're on edge because of what happened before, but this beautiful story that's being woven in and the conversation between the club owner and Vincent is so engaging that you're like caught up in this whole story. And then when it just slams the hammer down on the fact that this is going to end poorly for the club owner, you know, it's jarring.
Yeah, and I think that all of that rests really squarely on the shoulders of Tom Cruise. I mean, it's his charisma as a movie star that does mold you into that false sense of security and lets you sort of lose sight of what he is and sort of enjoy the moment right along with Max. I can't think of other actors who could have pulled that off so well. Who have that much charisma to make you forget that he's a psychopathic killer for a few moments, and really get drawn into his world.
And you're right. It's an amazing amount of like subtlety and nuance. Where if it was you know way more ham-fisted, it just wouldn't have worked at all. You know, you would have to have it would have to be an action movie to pull that off, and even then, it would have to be some sort of crazy action. You know, this was like a small thing. This is like a play.
Yeah, and you're right. But after that, that's when Max really, really starts to lose it. Yeah, he's about to crack. And right around the same time, he keeps getting calls from his dispatcher, that his mother is asking to see him. Turns out his mother's in the hospital. And once Vincent finds out about this, he forces Max to go visit his mother. And again, there are multiple layers. You don't know if Vincent's doing it because he wants to calm Max down, or you don't know if he's doing it because he wants Max to maintain his routine, so that he can more effectively frame him, at the end of the evening. Or the third option, which ends up actually being true, is he wants to make that connection with Max's mother to use her as collateral later on in the movie to threaten him to stay in line.
Oh yeah, no, you definitely get the idea that he's going to meet the guy's mother just to also say, okay, I know where she is, I know how to get her, and you already know that I can do that.
And in a really sad scene in the hospital, you find out that Max's mother thinks that he already has a successful limo company and doesn't know that he's still driving a cab. And that embarrassment of that being articulated in front of Vincent is so devastating to Max that he makes a run for it. He grabs Vincent's briefcase and runs out of the hospital because it's the only thing he can think of to do to actually get back at Vincent for being witness to his humiliation in front of his mother. And his mother wasn't aware, but he didn't take the fact that Vincent knew he was full of shit.
Well, and his mother also just disregarded him during the conversation with Vincent. Like, talked as if he was not in the room. So that was another layer of humiliation to put on there. He wasn't even like a big boy in the conversation.
So he couldn't take that. So he runs away from Vincent out of the hospital, and Vincent catches up to him just in time for him to throw the briefcase off an overpass on oncoming traffic and on a highway, effectively obliterating the contents of the briefcase, which were the last two of Vincent's assignments. So that leads to a scene where Vincent takes Max to his contact in town and forces Max to enter his contact's nightclub to obtain backup copies of the assignments. And Vincent is not known by his employers. He's never been seen, so Max can effectively impersonate him, which is really the only callback to Jason Statham in the beginning of the movie, who wordlessly dropped off the briefcase to him at the airport. So that seems to be Vincent's method of collecting his assignments through some sort of blind prop. And this I think is the scene that should have earned Jamie Foxx's Oscar, because he is certain that he is going to walk into the nightclub and get murdered, but he doesn't have a choice because Vincent threatens his mother. So he walks in pretending to be Vincent, and he's really, really bad at it to start off with. He's really meek, pathetic, and mumbly, but he makes his way to Felix, the contact, played by Javier Bardem, and through the course of the conversation with Felix, Max sort of begins to channel his inner Vincent, and it's just a great scene to watch him gain confidence throughout the conversation of Felix using Vincent's own words and own one-liners that Vincent had used on Max himself. He's now throwing those at Vincent and gaining confidence to act like a badass hitman. So much so that he successfully gets the backup documents and makes it out of the club alive.
There's other things going on in this part, because the club itself is under the surveillance of the police or the feds or whoever, both probably. So there are a lot of moving parts that fall into place at the club itself. Or no, right. Hold on. I may be getting this wrong. Is the club where he gets the backup documents, that's separate from Fever? Okay, all right. Okay. I'm confusing two locations. So, never mind. I'm sorry. So, it's the next scene where they have to drive to the club Fever.
Well, the Felix's club was under surveillance, and that's where the intersection of the storyline of Detective Fanning and Max's storyline first happens. So, as a subplot, the side plot Fanning had been putting together, that there were a series of murders. Vincent's first two assignments, as it turns out, were related to the same case. And, a visit to the coroner indicated that the victims from the alley, the muggers that Vincent had killed, the coroner tells Fanning that they were shot in the exact same manner, two in the chest, one in the head. So Fanning starts to put it together, and that sort of brings me back to a nice little scene when they're in the hospital elevator, and Vincent and Max are going up to visit Max's mother, and Fanning gets in the same elevator. He's going to the morgue. So they have a nice little moment there between Vincent and Fanning.
At this point, it wasn't, I mean, there's not a whole lot of action going on behind the scenes, but there is some. So, okay, so now they get the other assignment.
Yeah, and via the surveillance at Felix's club, Fanning starts to put together that this cab likely had something to do with the very first murder, the body that fell out of the window, which he found out at the hospital was related to the muggers in the alley and the killing of the second witness. So Fanning starting to put it together, he starts to track Max. So they are on Max as they head to the fourth assignment, which is another callback to Heat with a nightclub in Koreatown in L.A. I'm not sure why Michael Mann likes those locations, but there are some great scenes in Heat in a nightclub in Koreatown.
See, I don't even remember that. I'm going to have to obviously we're going to revisit Heat, most definitely.
Oh, yeah, the scene with Tone Loke. You can get killed walking your doggy.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to definitely revisit Heat.
Yeah. I'm sad right now.
I'm sorry. Feet of clay,
Yeah, so the nightclub scene, it's the biggest action set piece of the whole movie. The cops think Max is the killer, and they think he's going after this criminal who's also related to the same case. I'm not sure if he's a witness or a co-conspirator. That part was lost on me.
No, but, I'm pretty sure he was a witness that I think they thought he should have been in hiding, but for some reason wasn't.
Got to go hit a nightclub in Koreatown.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think he was like the big witness.
Yeah, the real purpose was to have a big shootout at the club as the cops are closing in on Max because they think Max is there to kill the guy. And while Vincent is actually there trying to kill him. So when the cops move in on Max, the witnesses guys start shooting. Vincent starts shooting and the cops start shooting. There's panic everywhere. There's some great action with Vincent just being a complete badass. Max being scared and terrified and thinking he's found his salvation as Detective Fanning, who has put it all together that Max is being framed, finds him in the club and escorts him out of the building. Along the way, Max is professing his innocence and Fanning tells him he knows. While Vincent is dispatching all of the witness's bodyguards and eventually assassinates the witness and makes his way out. And in a really, really sad scene for Max and Fanning, I guess.
Well, and me. And me.
And you. Another killing that you do not see coming as Max and Fanning are exiting in a crowd of people. Before Max can realize it, Vincent was already waiting for them outside at Max's cab and kills Fanning without any fanfare. Just two shots. Fanning's gone. Max is back in the clutches of Vincent and feeling the full weight of the emotional letdown of being so close to getting out of his predicament.
Yeah, you're right. And the Max character at this point, all is pretty much lost.
You know, things are not going great for Vincent. He's, after he lost his briefcase, he's having to kind of put his assignments back together. He's not happy about it. It's not going, as smoothly as you've come to understand his character likes things to go. So he's starting to unravel a little bit and he's starting to needle Max. And he needles Max a little bit too much and pushes Max past the breaking point as they're driving to the last assignment. They have a great exchange where Vincent starts to call Max out on his bullshit and explain to him that he sized him up from the very beginning and that he is obviously a man who has big aspirations, but no ability to put anything into motion. And essentially he's all talk. And Vincent pushes Max over the edge and Max realizes that he has never been able to pull the trigger in his life, and he knows he's going to die. He knows Vincent's going to kill him. So he realizes that if he is ever going to take a stand and actually take action, it has to be now. And he takes control the only way he can and speeds up and crashes his cab while Vincent's trying to get him to stop.
In a rather spectacular fashion.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. So it was the moment where Max finally did something real and took a chance, but didn't quite work out the way he wanted it to. Vincent was able to get out of the cab and limp away as the cops were coming. And when the cops get there, they start to help Max out, thinking he's just the victim of an accident. But then the cops see a dead body in the car. The body from Vincent's first assignment that they had stashed in the trunk. So he starts to arrest Max, and while he's arresting Max, Max looks down and sees Vincent's last assignment. And this is probably the only thing in the movie that made me roll my eyes. It was just too much of a coincidence for me that Vincent's final assignment was Max's lady friend from the first scene, the lawyer, played by Jada Pinkett Smith.
But it works because it allows him to have her phone number.
Right. So Max, with a renewed vigor after finally having taken action for once in his life, subdues the cop, decides to go after Vincent and try and save his lady friend. I don't remember what her character's name was. So, which leads to the last final act of the movie, which is sort of a chase and shootout where Max is trying to get to her before Vincent can. And this part didn't work too great for me. This was a little too action movie-y. For me, after being such a great crime drama all the way up until this point, this is where the movie started to lose me a little bit. But at this point, I've had so much emotional investment in the relationship now between Max and Vincent that I was way more interested in how that was going to play out than I was if Max was going to be able to save the girl. I don't know how you took this final act here.
Well, I think I agree. I mean, as we've been talking about this is a movie of conversations. Every conversation in this movie is like a beautiful thing. I mean, I've lost my words here, but I mean, the conversations make this movie. Every time there's a conversation, it's a wonderful thing. And then when they get into the brief periods where there's this action stuff, like I thought the nightclub was a little over the top, you know, the shootout in the nightclub. But it did lead up to that, the Fanning killing, which is, you know, again, it was, it added the right emotional tone, and it got the story back on the track that it was before. But the action parts of it, it didn't hold up as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. The biggest action piece in the entire movie, the nightclub, I was actually really bored with. I mean, it was pretty cool to see Vincent go, you know, all Terminator on a bunch of people. It was fun, but I got bored, and I couldn't wait for them to get back in the cab together.
Well, exactly, because
continue their conversation.
Well, and it all along you have this really narrow story. And occasionally it broadens out, including other people. But it was the nightclub scene where all of these other people that you've seen kind of converge in one location, except for the girl. And to me, that's where the story broadened out, is where, yeah, you lost focus that made the movie so far. Because you can't get that nuanced performance, or at least they didn't, you know, when you're running and jumping and hiding and ducking and shooting and that kind of stuff.
Indeed.
But the end of the movie, well, I'll let you go ahead and we'll finish the end of it, because it ended on that narrow note as well.
Yeah, had to watch it twice because I didn't realize what had happened. I didn't remember exactly how the movie had ended. So I remembered that Max did save the girl. There was a final, he rescued her at the last moment from Vincent in her office building, and they ran away from Vincent, and they ended up on a train, a commuter train, where a final confrontation took place. Max had a gun that he took from the cop, and Vincent had a gun, I believe he took from the building security guard, and Max was trying to shield the girl, and they end up in a showdown on either side of the door between cars on the train. And I think in a great way to end the movie, Vincent keeps advancing on him really without any fear that Max is going to be able to do anything. And in a rather effective, but really not heroic manner, Max, in a last moment of desperation, closes his eyes and empties his clip at the door that's between him and Vincent. And there's a little fake out where you see they're actually shooting at each other. You see Vincent go to put a new clip in his gun, or magazine, sorry, in his gun. And he can't do it. He loses his grip on it, and you realize that Max had caught him in the gut with a lucky shot. So he's mortally wounded, but still conscious. He slowly sits down, and Max,
who is also out of ammunition at this point,
right? Max and his lady were about to die. They were done for, except for that lucky shot. What I had to go back and watch is, it seemed to me that Max had just closed his eyes and fired wildly. So I didn't understand how he could have hit Vincent. But upon watching it again a second time right away, I realized that was sort of the point. There was a randomness to how he was actually able to defeat Vincent, which actually worked for me.
Oh yeah,
it didn't bother me.
Because Vincent doesn't believe that it happened either.
Right.
I mean, he's as shocked as anybody.
Mm-hmm. And they have one final moment across from each other as Vincent dies. Very reminiscent of my favorite movie of all time, Heat. But at least in this instance, the person who I thought should die, I. And that's exactly where the movie ended. I mean, there is no epilogue, there is no aftermath.
It's just, yeah. No, and I mean,
right there.
You don't really want to think too much about it because Max's life has not improved one bit.
No, Max is screwed.
Yeah, and so is the girl. Her case is screwed. Yeah, nobody has a happy ending in this whole thing, except that you can be happy that Vincent is dead.
And Max got the girl.
Yeah, well, sort of.
For the moment.
Yeah. You know, I think when we watch Heat, and I'm definitely going to, you and I definitely have to talk about Heat because I want to watch it again with this in mind, because I want to watch Heat through the prism of it being a movie about conversations also. Because there are some pretty dramatic action pieces in that. But I wonder if the fun is in the conversations. I don't know.
The biggest question is, when am I going to be able to carve out 4.5 hours to talk about Heat?
Oh, we can make it. Yeah, exactly. When you find the time, we can make it happen. Because, yeah, there's a lot to chew on. I don't know. I'm hoping we're going to have the time to talk about Apocalypse Now or Roadhouse when Jason's here in June. Because it'd be fun to sit around the table where all three of us can be plugged in and actually be discussing it.
Can happen.
Because you guys are a different audience. I mean, that you two are, you guys watch movies in a different fashion. We had talked about that earlier today, that you're more analytical. And I asked Jason how he liked the Creepshow episode. He's like, oh, I loved it. I learned something new about my little brother. You know? And he's, you know, because...
Oh, no.
No. The funny thing is, I mean, what he said was, you know, he doesn't, you know, listening to the conversation between you and I, you know, he doesn't get a chance when he's here. You know, he doesn't often get to hear you in conversation much. I said, yeah, it's because you and I, me and Jason, we do all the talking everywhere we go. Like, he can't get a word in edgewise.
It's true. I've done a lot of talking this episode, and I feel exhausted.
Yeah, well, sorry about that. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, again, it's a different thing, and it's fun. And I mean, we're kind of, because I have some more stuff to talk about Collateral. If you're interested,
I am.
Did you? Well, okay. There's two parts of the movies that I think I thought were pretty cool. There was a nice ratchet up of tension when after the first killing, where the guy's in the trunk, Max's cab gets pulled over by the police for a cab violation because he's got a smashed windshield. You can't have a smashed windshield and be a cab driver. So they actually are going to send, you know, he tells the cops that he's just going back to the cab stand or bus barn or whatever it is where they keep the cabs and turn in his car or get a new one or whatever. And he's just trying to ask them to, you know, give him a break. Partly because Vincent tells him, oh yeah, they probably have a wife and kids at home, and I'm going to kill them if you don't talk your way out of this ticket. So I thought it was a great, it ratchets up tension really well because, you know, he eventually tries to do it, but he can't do it. The cop isn't having any of it. So he pulls them out of the cab. Vincent's gonna kill these guys. The only thing that saves these guys' lives is the fact that Vincent had killed the guy in the first place because they have to go off to that crime scene.
That's right. Yeah. Max, in a spectacularly pathetic manner, fails to talk his way out of it, and they're gonna tow the car and look in the trunk, and Vincent's standing there, and he starts to get into his killing posture.
He draws his gun. So yeah. So I thought that was really effective, and the other moment I really liked was when. Although, at first I thought when Max did his turn at the club with Felix, where he, you know, he said that he was the meek guy and he couldn't quite pull off acting like Vincent, but then he musters up the energy or the courage or whatever to be able to just sort of wing it and kind of turns his persona around. Starts acting like Vincent. I thought, oh, this is gonna be bad because he all of a sudden had that Jamie Foxx gleam in his eyes that you hadn't seen, which made it so effective because you hadn't seen that the movie star Jamie Foxx. And you kind of see it when he turns and starts using Vincent's lines on Felix. But I loved when at the end of the conversation with Felix, he's like, but you know, for your trouble, I'm gonna knock 25% off of the price you're paying me for this. Oh, wait, make it 35.
Yeah, that was a great little comedic beat.
Yeah, he's like, you know, I can't...
Out of nowhere.
Exactly. At the very least, you're not going to get as much money, Jackwagon. Did you happen to look at any of the IMDb trivia about this movie?
No.
Okay.
Is there good stuff on there?
There's some good stuff on there. Edward Norton was offered the role of Vincent.
Yikes.
Yeah. There was an actor who was considered for the role of Max and even met with Michael Mann before they cast Jamie Foxx. That actor is none other than Adam Sandler.
Oh, no.
Can you imagine Adam Sandler and Edward Norton in these roles?
I can picture it. It's not pleasant.
And, I don't know, this may have pleased you. You know who actually was cast as Detective Fanning before he actually had to pull out due to a scheduling conflict with another movie, and Mark Ruffalo took the role? Val Kilmer.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
That could have been a weird alternate reality sequel to Heat.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing, is that he would have been the cop in this one. But I really like the fact, you talked about it before, but I really like the fact that the Vincent character is, I put in my notes that he was a cipher, but I looked that up online. I'm like, oh, that's not really the right word. I mean, you don't get any details about his backstory.
You get a little bit. He talks about having an abusive father, and then he mentions when Max asked him what happened to his father, he said he killed him when he was 12. And then after after a really icy beat. And just kidding. He died of liver disease. But I wish I'd killed him.
See, I got the impression that nothing he said could you believe as being genuine in any way. So to me, I mean, I guess I like the fact that they didn't really talk about the details of his employment at all. They didn't talk about, he kept it all very, very vague, which made him even more chilling.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
What was your take on probably the weirdest and most abstract moment of the movie when they're driving towards the last assignment and Max is pretty shaken up and muttering to himself and Vincent is getting frustrated that his evening has not ended yet and just it's a giant shootout and they run across a coyote crossing the road in front of the cab and it is a weird moment where the coyote stares at the car and Vincent stares back at the coyote and then they just move on.
Yeah, that, I mean, I remember thinking, huh, but I don't actually remember putting any particular, I mean, obviously it was done for a reason. So, I mean, are coyotes brutal killers? And he's seeing himself, or they're scavengers? I don't know.
Well, that's sort of what I was thinking was Vincent is, he's a predator. Out of place in a city. He mentioned several times how he doesn't like to be in L.A. And then there's just this weird wild animal crossing, you know, an urban roadway. So I didn't know if they were supposed to parallel each other. I'm not smart enough to figure out all the symbolism involved in that type of thing. But
no, I mean, I think you must
really
be right.
Strange. That was a definite departure from the rest of the movie.
But it was on purpose and it didn't last very long. So I think you're right. I think the point was that he was out of his element as a predator and the, I don't know. I'll have to think about that a little bit.
Yeah. I don't know if there's some myth around coyotes being like a harbinger of death or something. I don't know if that's a moment where Vincent knew he wasn't going to end the night alive.
Well, the coyote ran off, right? Yeah, I don't know. I'll have to think about that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I guess if I was better prepared, I would have listened to that bar.
Yeah, well, I think we don't have to look into the whole coyote Native American myth cycle or anything for just a free podcast. Did I mention it was a free podcast?
But, no, it was free.
Yeah, it's totally free. In fact, it's costing me money. Yeah. The movie itself, you know, it seems like when you mentioned it, I thought, huh, this, I mean, I know it's a Michael Mann movie, so obviously I could see why you liked it, but it didn't strike me as something that was particularly successful, like, you know, in the box office, but turns out it did just fine. It was, the budget was approximately $65 million and the domestic gross was $101 and the worldwide gross was $217. So it made its money back.
It's got a lot of star power behind it. You know, like I said in the beginning, this is Jamie Foxx's banner year. Have you seen Ray?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so if you were to put Max up against Ray, which performance do you think was Jamie Foxx's better performance?
Well, definitely Max was more subtle and nuanced and therefore maybe a better showcase for his talent. Because Ray was way over the top. And I don't know. I mean, I think he did a great job in it.
I did not like Ray.
You didn't like Ray?
I didn't like Ray.
Oh, well.
I thought he was fine. He sort of did the Val Kilmer thing. You know, Val Kilmer, Jim Morrison. Right? I think they did a fine job. But it just, like you said, it was over the top. It was very melodramatic. And as far as showing off his acting talents, I think Collateral was a much better vehicle for him to do that. And I think he did it well. So I think, you know, looking backwards, I think the Oscars that year are on the wrong side of history.
I'm not so sure, because he lost to Morgan Freeman.
For what?
$1 Million Baby.
Never seen it.
It's well worth seeing.
I guess. It doesn't sound interesting.
Yeah, I didn't think so, but I would recommend it. I mean, I'm not going to force you to watch it for the podcast, but and you want to watch it all the way through. But it's not, I don't know, it turns out it's not the movie that I thought it was going into it. And it was Clint Eastwood before Gran Turismo, so it was, you know, his...
He was still trying?
Yeah, he was trying. I don't know. It was well done. So, I don't know. I mean, Oscars, I mean, they like biopics. They like big productions, that kind of thing. So I can see Ray winning. And I've always admired Jamie Foxx's work in Rio. So I'm anxious to see Rio 2. Eager, rather, to see Rio 2. Have you ever seen...
He will always be Wanda to me.
From In Living Color?
In Living Color, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. He's a good guy. He's a good actor.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this.
Okay.
You saw Ray. You enjoyed Ray.
Yes.
Did you ever have any inclination to watch it again?
Well, no.
That's how I felt about it. But Collateral, I was very happy to watch Collateral again.
Oh yeah, no, I'd watch it again. Absolutely.
All right.
And so I think we can agree that JMO is just wrong, and her feelings about Tom Cruise are probably, I don't know, swayed by some other public thing he did.
Yeah, I would certainly recommend Collateral to anybody. I mean, I really, really enjoyed the movie. Probably one of my favorite Tom Cruise performances.
Yep, I can
right
agree.
Up there with right up there with Tropic Thunder.
Oh, Magnolia.
Yeah, he was really good in Magnolia. Hard to watch though.
Oh yeah, totally hard to watch. But he was so good, and I don't know. It turns out, you know, there are a lot of good Tom Cruise movies. Jason and I were talking about, well, you heard us talking about Patrick Swayze and Kenny Loggins and stuff, and I cannot imagine Top Gun being anything but absurd, like how bad it is on a review.
Yeah, Tony Scott, that would be another fun series to do.
I'm down for it, absolutely. I mean, he didn't end really well, but yeah.
Yeah, that was one of my next recommendations. When it's my turn to pick, because in my mind, this is how it's going to go. You're going to pick, and then I'm going to pick.
Yeah, that sounds good.
One of my next recommendations is going to be Man on Fire.
Denzel Washington?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've ever seen it.
I think it'd be a good one to watch. When I saw it, it reminded me of the type of movie that you and I would have gone to see together. To sort of kill off like a summer afternoon. What year did that come out? You know, I was well into my adult life, so it was past the time when you and I were hanging out every day, going to see copious amounts of movies. But it really did evoke that. It was that type of movie that, when I think back, it feels like a movie I watched with you in the theater, even though I know you didn't.
Are you down for Tombstone for next week?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Excellent. Okay, cool. I think our thing is getting better and better, and I'm looking forward to hearing feedback from people. Feedback is what we want. Let's see, how did I end it before? I don't know, maybe I just throw the generic ending in there.
You got to work not in a creepy way into your outro somehow.
Well, I do. You're right. I have to work it into the intro and the outro. At some point, not in a creepy way should somehow appear in the show at some point. So. Maybe with a new music, I'll be able to do a new song and dance outro. I don't know.
Yeah, I'll work on something for myself.
Okay.
But, yeah, this time around, I'll just say thanks. That was fun.
Yeah, that was fun. That's it. Thank you, Drew. And my name is Eric, and this is our podcast, Not a Creepy Way. Send cards and letters and cash.